It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We are all children of God, they sing, and pray for a miracle. The church was locked and sealed off just a few days ago. Now, worshipers have learned that it'll be demolished. The congregation is very angry and sad. For months, Islamists have protested on the street outside the building be pulled down. It's a difficult time for our parish. People are trying to restrict our freedom of religion, to take our house of prayer from us. For years, Christians worshipped here. Their troubles began when they sought to enlarge their church. They petitioned authorities for permission many times in vain. Theophilus Bella is an activist. He fights for the rights of persecuted Christians. In his opinion, Indonesia is becoming less and less tolerant. He blames local authorities for giving in to the demands of religious extremists. It has a lot to do with politics. Some mayors are after the support of radical Islamic groups, so they oppress Christians close to their churches and hope by doing so they'll win the next election. 90% of Indonesians are Muslims. Abroad, many regard Indonesia as a model Muslim democracy. But this too is Indonesia. Pull down the church, shout members of the Islamic Defenders Front. The group is well known.
It's hate minorities, both minorities within Islam, like the Ahmadi sect, the Shiite, and also the minorities from outside Islam, Christians, basically Christians.
For months, the West Javan congregation hoped this moment would never come. A police and military escort accompanies the bulldozer. It pushes through to destroy the church. Its walls tumble, and another victory for Islamists, and another blow for religious tolerance in Indonesia.
Sandy Rios with you. That was a CBN report kind of covering at least Christian persecution in Indonesia. You know, while we sort of fancy here in the West that the Islamic State has been pushed back, we're seeing fewer attacks here in the United States. It's not the case worldwide. It's just not the case. Islamic radicals are on the march in countries like Egypt and Iran and Indonesia, as you just heard, in Pakistan. And Nigeria, and countless other countries, and of course, civilization jihad is alive and well in Europe. So what's happening? Is this a new development? Have things changed? Are the Islamists looking any different than they did in the 7th century when Muhammad founded the religion? Our next guest has been studying Islam for probably most of his life, and I'm anxious actually to hear about his life. He's an American researcher and librarian. He's a translator. He's fluent in Arabic and, of course, English. He was born in the United States, but one of his parents was a Coptic Christian from Egypt, which we'll talk about. He is the author of 3 books. The latest one is Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. His name is Raymond Ibrahim, and he joins us today. Raymond, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Sandy. Very good to be with you.
You know, when you subtitle a book, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, my first thought is, how in the world do you find out what happened 14 centuries ago? What's your source for something like that?
Well, believe it or not, we have a lot of good primary historical sources for even the very earliest encounters in the 7th century between Islam and the West. So they're out there. Your question, however, sort of captures the sort of spirit of the age in a way, because a lot of people think that there isn't much out there, or they think, even worse, that they know what happened out there, which is basically a burgeoning, enlightened, tolerant Islamic civilization and a sort of backwards Europe, etc. But we have a lot of copious documentation in and of itself, and also that contradicts that myth.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because I just recently was reading in a collection of stories of various Christian martyrs. It wasn't Fox's Book of Martyrs. It was other people I had never heard of, actually. And one of them was a man who's called the first missionary to the Muslims. And in this moment, I can't remember his name, but he was out of Italy or someplace where Christendom was strong, and actually became a Christian late, was kind of a wild character. Kind of a story like...
You're not talking about St. Francis of Assisi?
No. His story's similar. He lived after St. Francis, many centuries after. But it was just a fascinating story, and same but different. So you just touched on this. Now, because my understanding is that the first part of Muhammad's public life was sort of peaceful, and that's why so many are quick to declare that Islam is a peaceful religion. But in the last part of his, I don't know what to call it, public life as the founder of Islam, it became very violent. Do you think that the manifestations of Islam now, all over the world, are kind of segments of those two extremes in Muhammad's own life?
Well, in a way, they do reflect it. And what you're referring to is known in classical Islamic scholarship as the Mecca versus Medina phase. It's known that the Quran, the so-called revelations or the verses that Muhammad spoke as the angel Gabriel supposedly dictated to him, go in two phases. And the first older phase is when he lived in Mecca. And that's where you get a lot of the peaceful, nonviolent, sort of tolerant tone comes up. And then when he went to Medina and became essentially a warlord, that's when you get the more violent, open-ended verses to fight the infidel and so forth. And in Islamic teaching, the prevalent view is one that the second, the more recent revelation, which is the violent one, takes precedence. So basically, the Meccan verses, the peaceful verses, had their time, but now those have been canceled by the violent anti-infidel verses. And the other view is that both are applicable in as far as how they apply to a Muslim. So for example, when Muhammad was when he was peaceful in Mecca, that's because he was actually outnumbered and weak and didn't even have many followers, just a handful. So he had no choice but to preach peace and tolerance. So it's believed that Muslims who, for example, find themselves living in America or some Western nation where they obviously are outnumbered and weak, then they should also emulate that pattern, quote those verses and so forth. But just like Muhammad, when they find themselves in a position of strength, then they should emulate and follow the more violent and open-ended war verses.
You know, the founding of Islam in Muhammad's life is fascinating, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, because we want to get to what's happening to Christians in the world today, for one thing. But you mentioned Gabriel giving him the angel Gabriel in his mind, and according to his story, giving him these revelations. But what about this? Where do the satanic verses come in? Did he not declare or claim that he had actually had a revelation from Satan himself?
Well, the satanic verses, that's a story. A lot, much of it is rooted in Muhammad's biography, where basically, in order to appease, his nemesis, his longtime opponents were the tribe, the Quraysh tribe in Arabia, and they were pagans. And they were polytheists, so they had gods and goddesses and so forth. So apparently Muhammad wanted to appease them, and so he actually made room for some of these goddesses as daughters of Allah. And so that's always been kind of held against him as that it's not that he's really out to preach the oneness of God, but rather he's out to say anything to get power on the one hand. And on the other hand, later on, to justify why he said that, came the story that Satan threw that at him, and he didn't mean to say that, but Satan sort of forced him to say that, and that's why he said it.
Okay, then. That may be why, that's why the cartoon that allegedly caused the attack in Libya makes sense when you think about Muhammad's actual life. The story is so convoluted that even a cartoon rendition of it, is even an accurate cartoon, is still a cartoon. I know that's right. Very offensive to Muslims listening, but it is a bizarre story. But before we kind of move to other things, you do some great writing for Gatestone. By the way, Gatestone is located in New York City, and I've had the privilege of being at some of their events. Gatestone writes about what's going on in Europe and the world in regard to a lot of different things, but they do write a lot about, at least Raymond does, write a lot about persecution of Christians. You've done a couple of really extensive reports. You did one in December, and you did one in January. And I just really think, Raymond, it would be a good to sort of talk about what's actually happening to Christians around the world this 700 years after, you know, 14 centuries after Islam was founded. If in all of your writing, where do you think the most severe persecution is taking place?
Well, excuse me. Well, you know, it's first of all, it's definitely happening in the Muslim world in general. Okay, but so the question is which Muslim countries especially, and we do actually have good indicators for that. Amongst the absolute worst are places like Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. Especially during the, you know, the Islamic State's presence, Egypt, Nigeria, Somalia, you know, basically, let's put it this way. There's a well-known human rights organization that annually publishes a report, and they've been doing this for decades, documenting the absolute worst nations to be a Christian in. And they document the top 50 worst nations. And habitually, every annual, about 40 of those 50 nations are Islamic nations. And then the top 10, the absolute worst nations, where basically being outed as a Christian is enough to get you slaughtered, habitually 9 out of 10 are Muslim nations. Usually the only one that's not is North Korea, which has its own pattern, of course. But so, you know, this has been going on for centuries. And the issue is a lot of people present it as if it's something went wrong, you know, as if everything was fine before. Yeah. But this is why it's important to, you know, be cognizant of what happened in history, because that's not the case. If you go back in the 7th century with the rise of Islam and you looked at the Christian world at the time, actually most of it was in those lands that we just described. It was in North Africa and Southwest Asia, the Middle East. So it was, you know, Carthage, North Africa, Egypt, to what we call Turkey today, or Asia Minor, Anatolia, Syria. That was the heart of the Christian world, and Europe was kind of secondary. And so most people aren't aware of that. So the question becomes, how did that change? How did North Africa and the Middle East become Muslim majority and called the Muslim world? And that's where history comes in, and that's where it's been very muddled and distorted and whitewashed, so that people just, you know, when I talk to people if I'm talking, someone will say to me, I feel bad for these Christian minorities in Muslim countries, but what are they doing there in the first place? And you see, that shows the ignorance that those people are actually indigenous to that. They are the original inhabitants. You know, let's say the Copts of Egypt, or, you know, the Assyrians in Syria and Iraq and so forth. Well, those are the oldest inhabitants. And but the reason their numbers have diminished, so let's say the Copts, who went from 90+% in the 7th century to 10%. So how did that happen? Well, if you delve into the history, and it's out there in primary sources, you find that what ISIS, the Islamic State, did and has done and does, you know, picture that on an exponential level, times 100. And that's what these caliphates and sultanates did to Christians. They completely persecuted them, financially extorted them, slaughtered them, enslaved them, destroyed and burned their churches habitually. And even in the Islamic sources, they will note that after every bout of persecution, large numbers of Christians converted to Islam. And the historian would say something like, Allah Akbar, praise be.
Yeah. My guest is Raymond Ibrahim, and it's an amazing story, and we're just starting. His new book is called Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. And there will be more when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Across the Middle East, Christians and the church have suffered terrible persecution, yet there is still optimism here.
I see the church is standing and standing strong with all of the difficulties and with all of the atrocities and all the persecution.
Egyptian-born Yvette Isaac believes that's because they're continuing the testimony of the early believers.
I really believe every day a new page of the Book of Acts is...
God wants the church in the West to know what's happening here.
There are brothers and sisters, Christian brothers and sisters, who are living there. And if it wasn't for them, first, we will not hear about Christianity in the West. Because of the church in the Middle East, Christianity spread all over the world.
Yet she says the pressure on Christians has been enormous.
That's where it's all started. And the enemy's focus is to destroy it. The enemy's focus is to empty the Middle East from Christianity. So he's putting all of this pressure. And we have seen all kind of pressure under the people.
She tells one story of an Orthodox priest and an evangelical pastor.
An Orthodox priest told me, you know, when there was no water and there are only few drops of water left, I would rather divide it with the evangelical pastor, because I know if we both live, we're going to be more powerful together. If I live and he dies, I'm weaker.
She hopes each part of the body of Christ will do their part.
What am I called to do? Especially in the Western world. The Western church needs to understand the importance of the existing of Christians in the Middle East at this time.
Chris Mitchell, CBN News, Jerusalem.
Isn't that something? It's, you know, as we watch the world and we see the reduction, I think of Egypt as in that report, the reduction of the percentage of Christians in the population to just almost single digits. It's an amazing thing. And, you know, you could look at that and say, well, they are succeeding. Islam is succeeding in extinguishing Christianity. And yet I have to say, because many of us believe in scripture and prophecy, we don't really think that's ever going to happen. And we also see other situations like in China, where the church was nearly extinguished during the Boxer Revolution and during the decades after that. And when Western world was finally able to enter, we found millions of Chinese Christians in the underground church. So God works in ways that we cannot see. Raymond Ibrahim is my guest. He is a senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. He's also associate director of the Middle East Forum, which is Daniel Pipe's organization. I have tremendous respect for Daniel. A Shulman fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. David is a very good friend of mine, as I was just telling Raymond. His book he wrote in conjunction with Victor Davis Hanson, another brilliant mind with tremendous judgment. I think that's one thing that sets Victor Davis apart from so many commentators. Raymond, I'm curious, in your bio it says that you were born in the United States, and it says I'm assuming one of your parents was a Coptic Christian from Egypt. Is that correct?
Both of them were.
Both of them were. Okay, it's not clear here. But obviously they taught you, they must have spoken Arabic in your home. I mean, tell us about what that was like growing up in the U.S. They kept the customs of Egypt, the customs of the Coptic faith. How did that go?
Right. So the advantage is, you know, being born and raised here is I was just immersed in general American culture and, of course, English language. But then at home, there was a lot of Arabic being spoken. I'd say the culture, you know, was, it was just probably like somewhat Egyptian culture, but with a Coptic kind of background, which is a little different than average Egyptian, of course. I kind of grew up luckily understanding that culture, that language, and of course, understanding Western culture, Western language, English specifically. So I think that really helped me understand and see events better than, you know, people who are just limited to one side. So I've always had an interest in this field, especially in history. So for instance, Victor Davis Hanson, you were mentioning him. He actually, I've known him for well over 20 years, and he was my professor in college. That's how I first got to know him.
Lucky you.
And my master's thesis was actually about the topic of my recent book. It was about the first military clash between the Western world, or Byzantium at the time, and Islam, which was the Battle of Yarmouk, which is actually now chapter one of the book. So I've always had that. I've had both, you know, a professional historical interest in that region, in the religions, in the clash. But I've also had the personal or experiential background to sort of back it up and understand it better.
Raymond, you know, my question, I'm just curious about this. You have a historical and familial interest in this, but a lot of people classify themselves as Christians in the general, you know, classification. I'm not Jewish, I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. So, and I think some Coptic Christians, some Christians of every stripe are that way. Do you really believe in Jesus? I'm just asking you. I mean, I just want to know. No, do you believe it, or is this just an intellectual exercise for you?
No, I do believe.
Well, yeah. So do I. I just think that's an interesting distinction, because just because your parents did, just because that's your culture, doesn't mean that you do. So,
I agree with you. I mean, the word Copt, you know, I mean, to me, that's like the word Jew. You know, it's both a religion, but it's also ethnicity. So, you know, there's a lot of Jews who are not necessarily believing in their religion. So there's definitely a lot of Copts like that, too.
Have you seen through your parents' eyes and people that you know in Egypt, have you seen any changes in the Coptic church since this last wave of persecution has broken out?
Changes, you mean
in its nature? No, not the doctrine, but just in the way the church operates, the way the people worship. I don't even mean the buildings. I'm talking about passion and things like that.
Well, I mean, there's this, the change would not be new, because contrary to what people think, you know, I mean, the thing about the, you know, Islamic terror and persecution of Copts and other Christians around the world, the problem is a lot of people are limited to sort of the tip of the iceberg stuff. In other words, we only hear about something huge, spectacular, like a bombing of a church, which happens often actually in Egypt, Coptic churches, or a burning of a church, or, you know, when the Copts were traveling to a monastery and in the desert, they got pulled out and slaughtered. So that stuff makes it to the news. And the problem is, when that stuff doesn't happen, people tend to think that things are not so bad or it's okay, but that's not the case. What's usually happening is, underneath that spectacular tip of the iceberg is a slow motion, constant bleeding in a very non-spectacular way. And so, for instance, Christians around the Islamic world are habitually discriminated against, let's say in the workplace or in schools. I mean, that's just a taken, and nobody, you know, nobody even talks about it, because it's not that exciting. For instance, girls are seduced, abducted, raped, forced to convert to Islam. Young boys, Christian boys, are you know, kidnapped and held for hostage, which is in their mind like a form of jizya, which the Quran, of course, allows Muslims to take from Christians and Jews and others. So there's a constant, as I said in that one report, you know, you got 50 nations and 40 of them are Islamic. But probably 95% of that persecution that people are experiencing is not grand scale, spectacular bombings. It's just very low level, constant bleeding. And that's the problem. People are not aware of that. And so if they don't hear of a church bombing or a mass slaughter, they think everything is okay. But it's really not, especially if you take it by a Western point of view, Western standards of human rights. Then every single Christian in the Islamic world's rights are continuously being transgressed every single day.
The thing that has stood out to me about many of the stories I've heard about Coptic Christians, but not just the Copts, other places like Nigeria, is that, again, the distinction between a general category of I'm this rather than that. Mm. You have people repeatedly refusing to recant their faith. Even being slaughtered in brutal, horrible, horrible ways, refusing to recant their faith and convert, which to me is the ultimate sign of a genuine faith. And I, you know, you put in the article that you wrote about the persecution in December in these various countries. Please let me read this, because I think this is fascinating. You cite this letter or treatise that went out from the Islamic State into Egypt. And it says, "Oh, you Muslims in Egypt, the Christians have been insolent toward you. They cursed our prophet and called each other to fight you. And you are sitting. Oh, you, have you forgotten who you are? Do you not know that you are their masters and they are the ones who should be humbled and subdued? By Allah, if you do not rise up against them, Allah will increase your humility. So go forth, O worshippers of Allah. Blow up their churches and monasteries. Kill their priests and monks. Do not show mercy toward any Christian, for they are all belligerent toward Allah's religion. They will never approve of you until you follow their religion. So blood for blood, killing for killing. Revive the raids of the heroes of Abbasiyya, Stanta, and Alexandria until they know who the Muslims are. I got one question about that, Raymond. That's chilling. But do you see, as you record and document these various outbreaks of violence and murder and all the other things you described against Muslims, do you see any difference in the way that looks and the way it looked 13, 14 centuries ago?
Not much. In essence, it's very much the same, and the patterns are very much the same. Burning of churches, attacking Christians because they're quote-unquote blasphemers, or Muslims who try to apostatize and become Christians. Those patterns are all the same. Of course, differences, a lot of differences are based on, you know, technological advancement. So back in the 8th century, they couldn't bomb a church, for example, whereas they do now. But it's the same animus. You know, that excerpt you just read, for instance, that's the spirit of that has been repeated countless times by Muslims to rile up Christians. To rile up fellow Muslims against Christians and other so-called infidels. So very much the pattern has not changed, and the hate remains the same, and the supremacist talk and so forth. The only differences, of course, are things like, thanks to technology, they can do more damage. For instance, there was no plane hijacking, no 9/11, you know, in the medieval era. But the same spirit behind it definitely existed.
You know, I'd be really interested to know, because I don't have to explain to you that the West... We have a lot of ignorance of history, but we are especially, except for 9/11, I'm not sure we'd know anything about the Middle East, really, to speak of. But when we think about the Crusades, there are a lot of common understandings that probably are not quite accurate. And I would really be interested to hear from you as a historian who studied this 14 centuries, how you would describe, Crusades 101, how would you describe what that was all about and what was the real truth?
Well, the Crusades are one of the absolute most misunderstood and intentionally misrepresented epics of history, because oftentimes they are presented in a vacuum. Let's put it this way. In my book, Sword and Scimitar, from beginning to end, you got 14 centuries of continuous warfare. About 90% of that is the Islamic world invading Christian European territory in the name of jihad, name of Allah, the sort of things that ISIS does. The Crusades was actually, and 100%, a rebuttal, a counterstroke against that. The most recent attack that happened was in Anatolia or Asia Minor, today Turkey, was completely being ransacked by Turkish Muslims. They were literally killing and enslaving hundreds of thousands of Christians. And the Byzantine Emperor called for help to Pope Urban. And that was the spirit of the Crusade. It was one to liberate the Holy Sepulchre, or the Church of the Resurrection, to Christians in Jerusalem, which was also being pillaged and sacrileged and so forth by Muslims. And it was to help Eastern Christians who were being persecuted. And that comes out regularly in the sources. Now, how is it being taught? It's not being taught like that. It's being taught, if you read some people like John Esposito or Karen Armstrong, they make it sound like right before the Crusades, everything was hunky-dory. There was nothing but peace and prosperity, and Muslims and Christians were getting along. And then all of a sudden, these greedy, prototypical white Christian imperialists decided to go to the Middle East. For what, though? We don't know. I mean, now they go, maybe you can say oil, but what was there then? Nothing. So they traveled and they died and they made sacrifices. But I guess what I'm trying to tell you is that the Crusades, there's so much literature about it, and much of it is to demonize it. But if you keep it in its context, it was a very small epic in the context of the nonstop war between Islam and Christendom, and B, it was actually very ineffective. I mean, the Crusaders managed to take a few cities, including Jerusalem, and then in about a century, century and a half, all that was gone and fell back to Islam. So it didn't even have much of an impact. But the other battles, we can talk about this later if you like, that I chronicle in the book, most of which were waged by Muslims invading Europe, had huge consequences that we're still feeling till today, including territorial changes, demographic changes, and so forth. But people don't know anything about it because there's this push to whitewash and minimize the first millennium of history between Islam and the West, because in that first millennium, you have Islam constantly acting as the aggressor and engaging in the sorts of things that ISIS does, but like I said, on an exponential scale. And you have the West suffering, including, you know, Western white Europeans were suffering exactly the same things that Middle Eastern Christians and African Christians and Asian Christians are suffering today. Also in the name of Islam, they were, I mean, up to 5 million Christians were enslaved in the medieval era, just in the name of jihad.
Oh, my guest is Raymond Ibrahim. Fascinating, Raymond. And his latest book is Sword and Scimitar. Sword and Scimitar, 14 centuries of war between Islam and the West. When we return, Raymond, I want to talk about what you just touched on. Certainly Europe is a mystery to all of us, and we're seeing sort of an invasion in this century, maybe not unlike the ones you're describing in your book in earlier centuries. But we'll come back and talk about it. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. We talk about so many threats, certainly to this country, whether it be the left, Marxism, democratic socialism, fill in the blanks. And yet, this whole threat of Islamic Sharia, I guess we should label it as that, is not a small thing. And we've been talking about the elections recently and the effect of, in many states, of the influx of Muslim communities. And I'm talking again about Sharia-adherent Muslims. Maybe Raymond will have a comment about that. But I think that's our greatest danger. And certainly Europe is ahead of us. We're seeing amazing things happen. Raymond just reported recently about a school in Germany who has, this might sound familiar, stopped celebrating Christmas, stopped singing Christmas carols because it's offensive to Muslims who are now not a small percentage of the German population. We talked recently to an Austrian politician who told us about the dangers that she is seeing in Vienna. The Christmas market's under attack, and how she's feeling threatened in her own apartment building. Her husband's a doctor. They live in a luxury building, and yet it's a serious problem. We talked to a gentleman in Bavaria, a journalist, who has been arrested for just simply stating the obvious about what's happening with Islam in Germany. And so the tension is growing, even though we may feel a little bit of relief from that here in America, at least for the moment. Raymond Ibrahim is my guest. His latest book is Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. Certainly, Raymond, I think of, correct me if I'm wrong, and I could be. I always think, you know, there are always waves of things. And I know that, like, during the Revolution, there was a wave of, Thomas Jefferson talks about the battle with the, M-O-S-L-E-M-S, the battle with the Muslims in the Barbary Coast. There are waves of strength. There was the Ottoman Empire. So how do you see that? Are there certain eras where you think Muslims had more dominance and then they faded and had more dominance?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I document a lot of that in the book. You know, the first wave was the Arab wave, which to Europeans, you know, they called them the Saracens. But, you know, the Arab wave, the friends and the family of Muhammad, the extended family and the first caliphates, of course, and so forth. So under the Arab wave, you actually get the, and few people again know this, you know, when we talk about the West, we don't realize that what we call today the West is really the westernmost remnant of a much larger civilization block that Islam permanently conquered. And that goes back to what I was saying. If you looked at the post-Roman Christian world, where people were all speaking Latin or Greek and they were all Christian, or the majority were, in the 7th century, when Islam came, after a century of warfare and conquest, almost three-fourths, according to some historians, of that landmass was permanently conquered in the name of Islam. And so we don't remember that. We just, you know, to us, the West is Europe. And you don't realize that actually North Africa and Southwest Asia was even more a part of so-called Western civilization than before. So all that happens during the Arab conquests, and they go into Spain and all the way into France, of course, and until they're stopped at the Battle of Tours in 732. But even after that, France and Italy continue it. People don't realize that in the 9th century, Muslims were actually, they had a base in Switzerland up in the mountains where they continued slave raids on Europeans, for example. But then eventually the Arab era fizzles out and the new champions of Islam become the Turks. Then the Turks come and they convert to Islam. They originally come as slave soldiers. Then they all become Muslims, and to them, Islam is just synonymous with jihad. That's all they do. They don't really even follow anything pious necessarily, but because they do jihad, that means they're good Muslims. And under their rule, of course, that's when all the Balkans get conquered and Constantinople falls, you know, basically the Roman Empire in 1453. And they go all the way up to Vienna, actually, in 1683. And you know, so you find, you know, 1,000 years after these raids began and the first war with Christian territory in Byzantium, and here they are now in the heart of Vienna. And what's interesting and what comes out in the book repeatedly, because we were talking about patterns, is 1,000 years later, you have the Muslim leader saying the same thing as 1,000 years earlier. And he tells the people in Vienna, you have three choices: convert to Islam, pay jizya, live as third-class dhimmis and so forth, or fight to the death. And you have the same patterns, the enslavement, the rapes of women, the destruction of churches going on and so forth. But then there was another wave that most people don't associate and they forget about, and it's the Mongol or the Mongolian or basically the Tatar wave. The Tatars or the Mongols eventually embraced Islam around the year 1300. And they were the scourge of Eastern Europe, especially Russia, you know, the Tatar yoke. People don't realize that much of that was had that Islamic Christian flavor, just like in Europe. And churches were attacked and they had to pay jizya, Russians. And it was a religious war again. And that goes on for centuries, really. So you have all these different waves and then all that gets defeated by Europe right around in the 1800s, you know, with the rise of imperialism and colonialism and so forth. You know, Europe takes a meteoric rise and Islam takes a massive nosedive to the point that it becomes forgotten. It's no longer relevant. And now we're seeing it come back and we're seeing all these different manifestations and echoes of history. And to most people, they don't understand it. And that's why, you know, that famous question that we all heard after 9/11, what went wrong, you know, as if it was always peaceful and something happened. Actually, that peaceful era, which was a product of the colonial era, was the aberration. That way, it just happens that we lived in that era. But if you look at the past and you look at the present, you know, the continuity is unwavering. It's hostility, it's violence, it's jihad. And now it's spilled over, as you were saying, in Europe. And so you're seeing these same exact patterns. So, for example, in the book, in Sword and Scimitar, I show you how from the very beginning, Muslims portrayed European white Christian women as promiscuous by nature, as existing for nothing else but copulation and to be enslaved. And that's all there is. And there's copious documentation of Muslims throughout the centuries saying this. And then what's funny is you go to Europe today and you find Muslims behaving in the same way. They're not only are they raping Swedish women and German women and British women and so forth, but they'll tell them things like, you know, you white women are created just for copulation, for sex. You're just sluts, et cetera, et cetera. And I was even reading about a story of how they actually abducted one woman and took her to Morocco and turned her into a sex slave. And that, of course, completely echoes history because Morocco and the rest of North Africa, Algiers and the so-called Barbary states, existed exclusively. Their economy was based on enslaving white Europeans and Christians, and as well as Americans. And you were mentioning Thomas Jefferson, the Barbary War. So that's what happened. They took and enslaved American sailors. So the continuity is definitely unwavering. The problem is we don't know this because history of Islam in the West has been completely rewritten. We are now taught the antithesis of what really happened. And, you know, back to the Crusades real quick. The only reason the Crusades are a big issue because that's the one epic where you actually have Christians marching onto Muslim land. And so it can be portrayed as the Christians are the aggressors. Okay, but all those hundreds and thousands of times that Muslims invaded Western Christian European territory we're not told that. And so it's presented in a vacuum. It's demonized. And it continues poisoning how people see the relationship today between Islam and the West in comparison to the past.
You know, the one thing that seems different, and I want to ask if it's different. The mystery of Europe and of the U.S. in many ways, too, which I've talked about many times at this mic, Raymond, is the welcoming of people to your shores who, if you really understood, you would know that their purpose was to undermine, outpopulate, and destroy your culture. This blind willingness, let me pick on Europe for a second. The European Union's demand that each European Union member state receive all of these Muslim so-called refugees who happen to be young military-age men. Is that new in the history of the Islamic wave of conquering non-Islamic peoples?
Oh, it's absolutely new. But, I mean, it's new because it's reflective of Western stupidity and ignorance. You know, the people of Europe for centuries knew and understood what Islam was and fought and died at its hands in all these battles, for instance, that I document in the book. There was never once this sort of naivete of, oh, come live with us and I'm sure you'll start liking us. And this jihad thing, you know, that's taken out of context, I'm sure. That never happened. That's all new. And it's a testimony to A, utter ignorance of other civilizations and especially the West's history with them, in this case, Islam. And, you know, it's a sort of secularization, materialism, where you don't understand and you don't appreciate any sort of metaphysical constructs. So the idea that, oh, they hate me for no lesser reason than I'm an infidel, that has become so unintelligible to people in the West because they're taught to think that people do things based on material motives, you know, economics or maybe a grievance or so forth, territorial issues, that it's not existential. But in this case, it is existential and it's made clear continuously, past and present. And so it's really a testimony to just utter Western ignorance and foolishness to not take this seriously and understand it and to just act like it didn't happen. And, you know, I'm going to bring in millions of people whose worldview is so antithetical to my own, but that doesn't matter because somehow they'll just assimilate. And especially when you look at the fact that we have precedents, we have decades of Muslims going into Europe and the majority don't assimilate. And you have enclaves and so-called no-go zones and so forth. And yet they don't learn from it. So there's probably something even worse going on behind in the background.
Yes. All right. So here's another, I think, obvious change, which is kind of like that, what we just described. You described the Crusades where European Christians, I will say European, Western Christians, fought against Islam, you know, organized and fought the Crusades, however effective they may or may not have been, and also other battles. But it seems now that the fervency to fight has waned. It's as though, and I lay this really, Raymond, at the feet of the lack of the crumbling of the tenets of Christianity, the lack of belief in it, the sort of half-hearted embrace of the faith of our fathers, at least here in the United States. It's a combination of ignorance and also faith. But we're not fighting like they did a few centuries ago. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. And I would even add that, you know, in agreement with what you're saying, this half-heartedness, it's also a worming in into Christian teaching and Christian doctrine that has basically taken half of Christian teaching and highlighted it and just thrown away the other half. And the half they've highlighted is the idea of turning the other cheek, you know, being tolerant and so forth. But that's not how it ever came out in the Bible or in Christ's teachings. You know, I mean, Jesus is the same one who actually beat up people, whipped them, and threw them out of a temple. You know, that wasn't cheek turning. For instance, he told people to repent, to change their life. He criticized their lifestyle and so forth. So somehow Christian teaching has been just warped into the belief that all we have to do to be good Christians is to be doormats and never say anything, never criticize, and just be doormats and welcome everyone and suffer for it. And that's just not historic Christianity at all.
Well, I agree with you, Raymond. I agree with you. I always say, I put it this way. I think, you know, of course, we've taken on our culture as all Christians, and I guess every religion, but I'll pick on Christians because I am one. we take on the culture in which we live, and a culture in America is being nice. And being nice is not a virtue of faith. It's not one of the fruits of the Spirit. There's nothing wonderful about being nice. That's about our reputation. And there are times to be angry, and there are times to fight. Right. We have just a couple of minutes left here. By the way, the book is called Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. All right, you're a historian, Raymond, and not a foreteller of the future. But as you look at the past and how the patterns have developed, what do you see? How do you see this projecting even 10 years, 15 years? What do you see happening?
Well, the similarities and the differences are as follows. Similarities is Islam is still doing what Islam does, okay? So that is an unchanging, unbroken line of hostility and contempt and so forth. So the big change is in the West. The West is stronger than it's ever been vis-a-vis Islam, and yet it's suffering from it. And that's because the West itself is undermining and itself and allying with the jihad.
Pretty fascinating, and we just touched on a little bit of it. Again, the book is called Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, a fascinating read. And Raymond, it's nice to meet you today, and I hope that we can speak again about this. It's great to have someone who has as much knowledge and understanding as you have, so thank you so much.
Absolutely, Sandy. Happy to anytime.
All right, thank you. All right, Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.